Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes the tiny landlocked Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan home to the world's most contented people? And what could it offer to a disaffected American journalist looking for greater meaning and satisfaction in her life? Approaching middle age a few years ago, Lisa Napoli took stock of her life and found herself second-guessing some of her choices. Why had she failed to build a life with a man she loved? Had she wasted her youth? And would she be able to grow old gracefully? Napoli knew she had a lot going for her, a loving family, good friends in L.A. and around the world, and a job at American Public Media's marketplace that many would have envied. She just wasn't sure that added up to happiness. So when an out-of-the-blue opportunity arose to shake up her life with a temporary consulting gig at Bhutan's fledgling radio station Kazoo FM, she packed a suitcase full of lip gloss and gold-toed dress socks, more on that later, and headed halfway around the world. Lisa Napoli's memoir about her adventure is called Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Lisa, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What I love most about this story is the giant leap of faith it took to make it happen. At the time in your life when you went, what made it seem like it was a great idea to take 6 weeks off and go to Bhutan?
Well, you know, sometimes something happens that or presents itself that you don't want to miss. Mm-hmm. And even though it may not make sense or have a clear end result, it just seems too good to pass up. And that's kind of what happened. I was just ready to do something different. Everything, like you said, was fine. I just needed something different.
You had signed up in LA for this positive psychology class that seemed in some ways to have primed you for this experience. Mm-hmm. The greatest takeaway was this deceptively simple exercise you were told to do every night in bed.
Yes, I'm so happy that you want to talk about it. It's called the Three Good Things. Mm-hmm. And basically, all you do every night before you go to bed is write down the three good things that happened to you that day. And I think what is so great about that exercise is that it shows you that every day big things don't happen to you. You don't get a new job, you don't get married, you don't have a baby. Every day is made up of just a lot of small things that are good, sometimes not as positive. And making yourself sit down every night in bed or, you know, by bed time and writing those things down really helps wire you differently to see that there is good stuff in your life every single day. You just kind of overlook it because you're so busy rushing around and looking for the big stuff. So
yeah.
I love that exercise.
Yeah, it's great because you found yourself throughout the day thinking, oh, this is going to be good to write down for later.
Mm-hmm, exactly, and that's what happens. After you do it for a really short while, you start to interact with people. On the plane the other day, I talked to a fellow on the jetway at the very end of the flight, and it was such a lovely conversation. And you know, before I would have had that conversation and thought, that's nice, but now I realize that that's the real gift of every single day, is that moments like that, smiles from strangers and interesting light hitting buildings in the sunshine or the sunset. It's just a wonderful exercise.
So talk about work. You had this very cool, if not glamorous job, reporting and anchoring for Marketplace, but the work itself had started to frustrate you.
Well, you know, I think a lot of jobs seem glamorous, and really in the end, they're just, you know, I was sitting around on the phone a lot and on the computer, and yeah, I was talking to people, and I had this immense privilege of being able to broadcast out to people, and that's wonderful. That's a fantastic gift. But after a while, after 25 years of working in various forms of media, so much of media now is done this way, by the phone, by, you know, by electronic means. I wanted to get out and see something, but I just didn't know what that was. I didn't know how that was going to happen for me, and then this bizarre opportunity presented itself, and I took it. But the job was great, and it just, it's very fast-paced, and I think that was wearing on me, too. I wanted a little bit of time to stop and reflect that I didn't know how to give myself in any other way.
So, Lisa, the one thing you really knew about Bhutan before you were invited to travel there was that it is known as the happiest place on earth. This is a place that it's a national, there's like a national ministry, right, to measure and quantify gross national happiness?
That's happened more in recent years, because what's happened is that the outside world has become very enamored of this concept, and it's such a catchy slogan, gross national happiness. So the country itself has been sort of forced in a way to come up with ways to metric, because measure it. Everybody, of course, you hear, oh, yeah, we're going to measure our gross national happiness. Well, what does that mean? What does that look like? How do you measure that? Well, Bhutan never had an answer for that. Basically, it just said, we want to grow deliberately and carefully, not rampant, crazy growth. We want to preserve our culture as well as our environment, not just let it get mowed down and become a melting pot the way the United States has. We want to have good governance. We want to have people running the show who we can trust. And those were the things that they looked at. But outsiders, Westerners in particular, really wanted a more specific metric to measure that. So they had to institute a way to examine what happiness is, what it means, how the government can intervene, because, of course, that's a strange thing to think about, is the government being part of your happiness. And that's what's been happening over the last few years, is how to formalize that study.
It is such an inspiration when you look at Bhutan, like, because essentially it was run by a monarchy, and they willingly said, we need to convert, we need to open up a bit more to the outside world, and we need to convert to democracy. That's not something that often happens sort of at the command of the people who have held all the power.
Well, especially when you look at what's going on in Egypt right now and other parts of the world that have been long troubled. The idea that a king who wasn't under the gun, so to speak, literally or figuratively, from his people to give up power, would do that is remarkable. Could it happen in any other place that was bigger than Bhutan, that had more than 650,000 people? Who knows? But it is an interesting part of the story that this king, after having spent his entire reign opening Bhutan up slowly and deliberately, he picked up where his father left off. He let in tourists and let people go out to study more, and roads were built and villages electrified. He's done that very slowly and deliberately, and this is sort of the linchpin of all of that, getting to this point.
And the crown prince, who is now king, sold his fancy car to build this radio station.
I love that part of the story, too. It's just so fantastic when you think about pledge drives and all big media and all the stuff that's going on in the world, that, you know, you could sell one fancy car that was a gift and you could set up a whole radio station. Would that were be true anywhere else? But he did, and he saw, and the founding fathers, if you will, of modern Bhutan saw that media were a great and important tool to democracy, which is, of course, something that we kind of start to forget here. We take it so for granted. And that's been very interesting to watch because, of course, now you have a bunch of people running around with microphones and notepads questioning this new government, and the new government starts to think, well, maybe that's a little annoying. But they also, I think, seem to understand the importance of having the check and balance of the media.
So all of this is taking place off in the Himalayas, and you drop in almost by chance at a cocktail party in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us what happened.
I had taken that happiness class that we talked about, or was about to. I can't remember right now. But I was on this search. I knew I had to change something in my life. And then all of a sudden, I went to this party where I was going to meet a friend, trying to find a friend in a big sea of people at a party in New York, which is where I'm from originally, Brooklyn, New York. And there was this handsome man, and the handsome man was, it turned out, a friend of the friend I was going to seek in this big sea of people. And we were chit-chatting, and as you know well, people love talking about public radio, and they love hearing about it, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful cocktail party problem to have. Everybody wants to talk to the person in public radio and tell them your opinions. And this guy was doing that, but he was very cute, and I was single, and I thought, wow, he's very handsome, but he lives very far away. And he was about to go on a trip to Asia, which he does very frequently for his work as a tea importer. And he offhandedly said, you should come on this trip. And I thought, wow, I wish I could, but I can't. And a few weeks later, he wrote to me, and that's something you could never have done from Bhutan, or any place for that matter, until fairly recently. Wrote to me by email and said, would you be interested in coming here? And I thought, yeah, of course I would. I don't understand the logistics of it, but yes, I would. He wasn't there. I wasn't like I was going to see him,
yeah.
But the invitation was alluring. So.
And what was your role going to be at this radio station? Did I say it correctly, by the way?
It's Kuzu FM.
Kuzu, okay.
Kuzu is short for Kuzu Zampo, which is hello, which is very cute that's what they decided to name the radio station. Kuzu needed professionalizing. They, as I learned, and as anybody listening to this knows who's traveled internationally to do work, especially in NGOs, non-governmental organizations, people love outside help. I mean, I guess we're pretty consultant crazy in the United States, too. And they just wanted the idea that somebody who had a resume, that had a background in that world, would come and just sort of imbue themselves on the staff. And they didn't really know much about me, and I have a pretty nice resume, especially for a gal from Flatbush. I've worked at the New York Times and MSNBC and in public radio, not that international people always know what that is, but I had worked in a lot of different media. And so they wanted somebody to come basically to help them get up and running. They'd been up and running for a couple of months, but they wanted to figure out how to sell ads. They wanted to figure out how to broadcast more clearly. And that's really all I knew when I went there. I kept asking in a very typical Western way, what do I prepare? What do I bring? You know, do we have workshops every day or every week, or how will the days go? And they kept saying, oh, don't worry about it. You'll get here and we'll figure it out. So very different than how we would approach that sort of thing.
Journalist Lisa Napoli is my guest. Her new book is called Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. We'll resume our conversation with Lisa in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Taking a quick break from this conversation now, Jeff Whittington joins me. We are encouraging you to help us bring home this membership campaign that we are having. It is the winter membership campaign. We don't want it to leak into the spring membership campaign, but we have just $137,413 left to raise, so we should be able to wrap this up here quickly with your participation at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And if you'd like to get a copy of Lisa Napoli's book, Radio Shangri-La, we can thank you with that. When you join the station at the $120 level or above today, just go online to kera.org and check it out, or call 888-694-6931. $137,000 left to raise. This is 24-hour territory here, and we could, if you would go ahead and make your contribution today, maybe you got yet another snow day here in North Texas, and that's contributing to your happiness factor, and you're able to listen today without the daily pressures of kids at school or getting, you know, running your errands or getting stuff done at work. Maybe take a moment to call KERA or go online to kera.org and make that contribution today so that perhaps we can wrap this drive up in the next 24 hours or so.
It's so exciting to be able to serve you with different perspectives on things that happen in the world. Right now, this is a very sort of up-close and personal look at Bhutan with Lisa Napoli. In the next hour, we're talking about global power with Joseph Nye. Not exactly topics that seem to be related, but in fact, they look at the state of the world today and the place of Americans and Westerners in the rest of the world and the roles that we can play. Your role in public radio, your role in KERA is not only as a listener, but also as a financial supporter. We exist because of your dollars to the station a couple times a year when we come to you, and we appreciate your participation. You can go online now to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. At or above the $120 contribution level, you can choose a copy of Lisa Napoli's new book, Radio Shangri-La.
Yeah, it's our way of saying thanks for you supporting the station. In addition to the great radio you get here every single day, 365 days a year, even on a snow day. So do your part right now. Go online to kera.org, support this program and all the programs you hear on KERA, or call 888-694-6931.
Turns out it's not really such a snow day as kind of a blowy, ice, ugly, cold, misty day.
Wintry mix day.
A wintry mix, exactly. Hope you are warm right now and in a safe place. And if you're driving, please wait to pick up the phone. But if you are in a good place, give us a call at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org to make your contribution. We appreciate it.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lisa Napoli. She's a journalist formerly with Marketplace. Her new book is called Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. So before you head for Bhutan, you're running around, as we journalists do, first of all, trying to learn everything you can. One of the things you are told is that you should bring along two unexpected gifts for people that you would encounter.
This is such an amazing thing. I mean, we go places. I had gone to Africa years before, and I didn't know what to bring. In Bhutan, I was told to bring gold toe socks, but not just any kind of gold toe socks, but long ones. And someone explained to me that the reason for that is because the men and women in Bhutan are required, at least especially during the day, work day and school day, to wear the national dress. Mm-hmm. And for the men, that's something kind of like a bathrobe. It's beautiful, but it hits the knees the way a men's bathrobe hits the knees. And so it's cold there sometimes, and also men don't want their calves to be exposed. So they've taken to wearing these long gold toe socks, and that's just so fantastic. It's an obvious present to bring. And also, you know, imagine me. I'm this little 5'2 gal going into the department store and buying 10 pairs of these long men's socks. And the lip gloss and the tea were just things to bring for ladies that were nice little equivalent gifts, but they weren't as fantastic as the gold toe socks.
I thought it was funny that they didn't want fancy loose leaf tea. They wanted like Lipton tea in the bag.
Well, it's a fascination for anything that's not, you know, possible to get where you live, right?
Yeah.
We love,
yeah.
You know, I love eating my European chocolates. So they love having something that looks American or what they perceive to be American.
So you arrive there, you have this young, really enthusiastic staff that is working at the station. Talk first, though, about they found for you what appeared to be the fanciest apartment they could get for you.
It really is. And in my many trips back, I lived there for an even longer stretch a couple of years later, I've really come to appreciate just how fancy this place was. It really was just a service apartment for expats, and it was just a very simple one-bedroom apartment. But it had amenities that other places don't naturally have. Even in the city, I was living in the city in Bhutan, which is far different than the people who live in the most remote villages, where there is no running water, in many cases not electricity, and even more so, no roads. You know, you have to walk for hours to get there. I was in a city which was automatically 50 times cusher than any place else, especially for a city gal like me. But I had a hot water heater and running water in both my bathroom and my kitchen, which was very, very, you know, fancy.
And I love that your friend said, you have a geyser in your kitchen. Isn't that awesome?
Well, and you start, what's so amazing when you travel, but especially when you live in another place and you have the privilege of that, is that you really start to appreciate what you have at home in a different way. You know, you're living in a place where running water is a pretty fantastic thing. You start to think, well, yeah, my kitchen at home isn't so fancy, but man, it's got a lot of pretty great stuff. So that's the biggest gift I think I got from living there. And people even who travel there talk to me about that too.
There's this poignant moment where they say, well, we've seen American TV now, and we know from watching Desperate Housewives that you probably won't like this place very much.
Yes.
I guess TV is what, about a decade or a decade and a half presence in Bhutan?
Just 11 years ago.
Hmm.
Yeah. So you have people who are, you know, my age, who didn't grow up with the reference point of television and movies. And then you have people who are, you know, 25, who at age 15, all of a sudden, it's kind of like for us when we got the internet. You know, I was an adult, I covered the internet, but it still was kind of a freaky, amazing tool. And this is what it's like in Bhutan when you talk to people who, there's a generation of people who can't imagine life before television, of course, and then there are slightly older people who can. And you really, that's, I think, why for me it's such a fascinating place. You start to see, you know, that television changes lives. You know that it's an insidious force, but you don't really think about it until you're with a bunch of people who didn't have it.
So one cool thing about this radio station, Ragtag as it was, is that it is this brand new thing. And it does in some ways remind me of the early days, maybe of public radio specifically, yes, which was so experimental. They've essentially got this tool, this medium, and they can do with it whatever they choose.
Yep, yep. It's exactly the opposite of what we have in almost everything we do. It's very, except maybe our homes, it's very rare that you can just sort of barrel in and go, hey, let's think about how we might make this fun or make it work. That's why I've always liked working at startup organizations, because it's a clean slate. And here you had a radio station, which is the coolest thing of all. And it wasn't really under tons of pressure, as most ventures here are, to make money. Mm-hmm. So it could really do what it wanted to do. And the funny thing is what it ended up doing, which is playing a lot of illegally downloaded pop music.
Can you talk about, you looked out, there was sort of a deck, and we'll talk about the architecture in a little while. For one thing, I'm from El Paso, so we have to hit this. You went out on the deck, and you realized that growing wild everywhere surrounding the station and on the hills is marijuana.
Yes.
And they feed it, it's not the reason it's the happiest place on earth, because they feed it to their pigs.
They just feed the pigs with it. That wasn't a recreational drug for anybody there. It was just a weed, literally. And they, you know, nobody had any use for it, so they just fed it to the pigs and realized it made them fatter and happier than they were already. And that's kind of a quaint and charming thing. What's not so great is that there's a lot of drinking that goes on there, and people are starting to see that weed is an intoxicant, and, you know, there are the associated problems with that.
Tell us a little bit about the staff you worked with.
I love the people I worked with at Kuzu FM, and a couple of them are still very good friends to this day. They were mostly in their 20s. Some of them were in their late teens, mid to late teens from high school. But they were first job for most of them, and many of them had grown up in the city, so they were a little bit more sophisticated because they had that city edge. And a few of them had gone to school in India, which is very common there. They go across the border for college to India. And they were just so eager and enthusiastic about their lives. They weren't all so eager and enthusiastic about their jobs. But, you know, it's so much fun. And I've always respected and admired teachers. But what a privilege and a gift it is to be around a group of young people who just really didn't understand quite how huge the transition their country was going through, but sort of on some level, they just were so appreciative to have me there, the way many students are with their teachers. But I wasn't a teacher per se, and I wasn't their mom, and I wasn't their big sister, but I was kind of a combination of all those things, and they were all those things to me, students, kids. They were just people who I loved talking to and still do about what their struggles are day to day, you know, and in the end, their struggles are slightly different than the average person that age in this country, but very similar, you know, boyfriend issues, girlfriend issues, work issues, juggling everything issues, which, of course, is how Bhutan is changing so rapidly, because those were things that they wouldn't necessarily have had to deal with just 15, 20 years before.
Another thing that's changing, which I thought was fascinating, was the way people commit to each other for lifelong relationships. It once was that marriage was a relatively casual institution, and now because of the influence of the outside world, weddings are getting bigger and divorces are getting uglier. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, as with almost everything we could talk about with Bhutan, it's very much how it was in this country 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. I mean, people have always... Marriage is a serious institution in this country, but it wasn't something where you would go and date 500 people before you committed to marry someone. My mother wasn't like that. You know, her sisters weren't like that. My ancestors, no one's were. That it was just you got married, you had kids, you had business, and you dealt with it all, or you dealt with the home. That was how it worked. And that's sort of how Bhutan was, except it was even more casual because there wasn't a lot. So, you know, even the richer people there, when there were pairings, marriage, it was about the land and working the land. And, you know, you married someone because they were in your village and it was the right time to be married. And that was it, you know, no big deal. And now you see on television desperate housewives, and you see even in the Bhutanese culture, there's more and more movies being made, and you see these through lines where there's the last Bhutanese movie I saw, I can't even remember the name of it. It was a young couple who'd just become married, and they did something very modern, which was not live with either of their families. And they had a little apartment, and they were the first scene of this movie was them sitting around opening all these lavish wedding gifts.
Hmm.
And that's something that never would have happened in Bhutan before.
Talk about what it looks like there. And we should say it does not look like El Paso, but that's going to, I guess, preface the story that I'm going to lead you to.
It does not look like El Paso. It has mountains. It's a beautiful, pristine culture. I've been all over the world and the country. I've never seen anything so untainted by human hands.
Mm.
You know, miles and miles and miles of just untouched land and mountainous, rocky, very rocky. It's a very difficult place to build roads in because it is so mountainous and rocky. It is, when it's green, it is this vivid, magnificent, almost like the Teletubbies field of green. Isn't that a terrible cross-cultural reference?
But we all know what you're talking about.
But you know, right? And it's just so beautiful. The people are wearing these colorful dresses. They're not a lot of New York City black wearing gals. They're really wearing gorgeous, vivid colors. And everybody, there's something about that homogeneity in the way people look and in the way they dress that makes it seem like they're all going to just dance into chorus and start singing at any moment. But there's cows everywhere. It's just magnificently beautiful.
And the buildings are unique in the world, really.
Yeah, it's a kind of architecture. I guess the best way to describe it is a sort of a Swiss chalet, but not really. It is hard to describe. They're very functional houses. In some parts of the country, the animals live on the first floor of the houses, and the people live above. And that way, you know, you protect the animals from the outside world. And then they're tall structures. They're big structures, although, as in many places, people often all sleep in the room near the fire, which is the main room. And then there's these very interesting-looking roofs that are very colorful. So they're very interesting homes.
Lisa Napoli is my guest. She's a journalist whose new book is called Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes with Lisa. Right now, we're going to pause to ask you to make a contribution of financial support to KERA. We are down to $137,413 left to raise. We would love for you to participate in this by going online right now to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. If you make a contribution this afternoon at or above the $120 level, you can choose to receive a copy of Lisa Napoli's charming book, Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. This really is a really fun read, very poignant in some areas, very personal, but just a really wonderful book to read.
And it's yours with our thanks when you call 888-694-6931 or contribute $120 or more online to KERA. At kera.org. I want to thank Jenny Marianow and Alexandria, Virginia. Thank you, Jenny. Thanks to Nancy Lawrence and Garland as well. Cody Metter in Dallas. Rachel Buchanan in Fort Worth. We also heard from Brett Wilcox in Dallas and Patty Gearhart Turner in Fort Worth. These are the folks that are funding your radio station, folks. Those of you who have yet to make your contribution, these folks are paying the bills so that this station is here for you to listen to day in and day out. And I believe, and I said this yesterday, that everyone who listens to public radio, there's a kernel in there somewhere, even though in today's society we are trained to resist the pitch and trained to just automatically say no when someone asks you for something.
Because you're a public, down.
Yeah, because you're a public radio listener, there's a kernel of hope in there that I've got for each of you, that you will call, that you will contribute to the station at some point. And I ask that you make it today because there's just $137,000 left to raise. We know how many people listen to the station week in and week out. It would be really easy to reach that goal if everyone would call in and make a contribution.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to KERA.org. Really, the station is certainly bigger than Kuzu FM, but we are still a partnership. We are still a station that is here in this community, you know, run by people just like you who live next door to you. Our interests are very much in North Texas, but we like to consider the entire world, because just because we're local doesn't mean that everything we talk about needs to be local, because that's not a full understanding of the world. It doesn't fully explore the things you're curious about. It's our privilege to be able to provide this show for you 4 days a week, 52 weeks a year, minus a little vacation here and there. Your contributions, though, make it possible, because it's expensive to create local programming. It's more expensive in some ways than bringing something in from outside that is made for someone else by someone else. This program is specifically for you.
Of course, the national programs have a cost as well. Morning Edition costs almost $500,000 for us to air here on KERA.
Okay, that one's more expensive than our show.
it's quite a bit more expensive. It's $493,000 a year for us to air Morning Edition. I mean, that's, you know, and then we also pay for Marketplace, which Lisa Napoli used to work on. We pay for All Things Considered. We pay for the Diane Rehm Show. We pay for Fresh Air. And, of course, we also have the expenses related to producing the local programming you listen to be able to connect with Lisa Napoli today and our guest Joseph Nye in the next hour. We had to make a phone call to connect with them for the hour. And, you know, that has a bill. You know, when you have several phone guests a week, you know, for an hour a call each time, that adds up. And, you know, somewhere we've got to raise the money to pay those bills so that you can have this show to listen to. We're asking you to do your part right now by contributing at KERA.org or by calling 888-694-6931.
We've come down by more than $1,000 in the last couple of minutes. So that must mean we have many of you calling, which is wonderful. Our goal remains $136,430. That's with an overall goal of $700,000, so we're making great progress thanks to you. Love to hear from you next at 1-888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org.
1-888-694-6931 is the number to call, or go to KERA.org. Make a safe and secure donation there. Your dollars go to work right away when you use your credit card, but you can sign up as a sustaining member as well. You can learn all about that on the website or when you call 888-694-6931.
You can receive a copy of Lisa Napoli's book, Radio Shangri-La, at or above the $120 contribution level today. Hope to hear from you soon. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Lisa Napoli, author of the new book Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Lisa, UTEP did not have its first Bhutanese graduate until 1978. So why these days does it call itself Bhutan on the Border?
Oh, this is my favorite part of all the great, crazy, wonderful, strange things about Bhutan. It turns out that the woman who was the wife of the first dean of what was then called the Texas School of Mines read a National Geographic article in 1914, and this is the first dispatch ever filed from Bhutan in National Geographic, April 1914. And she's sitting in her place in El Paso and fell in love with the kingdom and these images that were taken by a man named John Claude White. And when the Texas School of Mines burned down, there were only, I think it was three or four buildings at that time. No, it was one building, and then they built three or four from that after that. This woman, Kathleen Worrell, said, let's build the school to look like this place, Bhutan, because in these pictures, this place, Bhutan, very much resembles El Paso. She saw the land. If you look at these pictures, you can see that, too, this landscape, black and white photographs, mountains, rocky terrain looks, you know, very similar to El Paso probably did at the time. So her husband agreed and commissioned architects who built buildings that looked like Bhutanese structures, and all based on these pictures that were in the National Geographic magazine, because, of course, at that time, it was very difficult not only to get to Bhutan, but you weren't allowed to get to Bhutan. They weren't allowing people in. This one fellow, Jean-Claude White, worked for the British government. That's the only reason he got in. So UTEP now looks like a little Bhutan, and I'm sure there are people listening as you're from there. Did you know that when you were growing up? Did you have any idea?
I remember asking when we first moved there, I was in high school, and I remember asking somebody what this was, and somebody said, oh, it's Bhutanese architecture. But I didn't learn the story until several years after that. But it is kind of strange, and they're pretty serious about it. So you can't put a new sort of building, like many college campuses will deviate from the old style and put a brand new communications building in. All the buildings there continue to be made in the Bhutanese style.
Yes. And there was a deviation in the 60s, and apparently there was an outcry. So they, you know, President Dr. Diana Natalicio is a big proponent of the relationship between UTEP and Bhutan. And so in the last 20 years, as they grow, and they've grown enormously, apparently, I've only been there in more recent years, it continues to look like Bhutan. It's really an amazing place with artifacts. You really don't have to go to Bhutan, although if you can, and I suggest that you do, but you've got this treasure, El Paso, that I don't think a lot of people realize. Lots of Bhutanese artifacts around the campus, a growing Bhutanese population of students on the campus. It's pretty remarkable.
Now, not long after you got back, one of your good friends came to visit you in the U.S., and I wonder if you can talk about whether her visit also helped you to see your own environment through different eyes.
Yeah, again, you know, it's like I grew up in New York, and people would come see New York and had never seen it before, and that made me appreciate that I lived in this big city that people spent lots of money to come see. Same thing with my friend Nawang when she came to visit me in Los Angeles. Part of it was, again, that she was a much younger person. She was close to half my age and had a different sort of sense of what she wanted from the world. She wanted to come to the United States and make a lot of money somehow. Didn't matter how. She just wanted to make a lot of money. And I have never been wired that way, thus my career as a journalist. But the way she looked at the United States was very much the same as my looking at Bhutan. Clear, fresh eyes, seeing the place that you see every day and take for granted, really help you understand what's great and difficult about where you live. And just her reaction to how diverse the population was kind of mind-blowing. I mean, of course I know that this is a melting pot. I'm the children of immigrants, but it's still kind of amazing when you see someone in that kind of context just kind of literally flip at every turn, everything from the UPS man to the self-flushing toilets at Marketplace to the buildings, because the architecture is so homogenous in Bhutan. To see big, tall glass buildings that weren't just white were pretty amazing. So that helped me to see that where I lived, I never thought where I lived was bad. I just thought it was a little bit too big and too crazy and too crowded. And, of course, it is all of those things. But it just helped tamp down this sort of disenchantment I had with being in my place. It's kind of like it's a wonderful life, you know? It just takes something to tweak you and make you see that it's not so bad where you are after all.
Do you feel like Bhutan changed you, or do you feel like you changed yourself?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's a maturity that only people, once they get to a certain point, can see about themselves, the acceptance. That's why I wanted to write this book, Chris, because I love, you know, who can relate to Bhutan or to me? You know, nobody's got the same exact story, but we all really sort of do. We all sort of reach a certain point in our lives where we're going, what's up with that? Why did I do that? Why did I marry that man or not marry that man or have these children? Or why didn't I have more children or go this way? And for me, I think it was just a point that I got to and a catalyst, an alchemical reaction somehow that just sort of helped me to sort of work through the stuff and just feel much better about where I am and who I am and what's going on. and lucky. I feel so enormously lucky, as should most of the people out there who are listening. You know, we're just so fortunate to have what we do, and I think we forget that. We're wired to feel the lack as opposed to feel the abundance and goodness that's around us.
Can you talk about the one souvenir that you wanted to bring home for yourself?
Ah, yes, my ring. I'm looking at it now. I'm not a big souvenir person, but there was this beautiful ring that's worn by mostly older people because the younger people can't afford it. It's one of those things that's passed down. It's a hammered gold with turquoise ring that in Bhutan is worn as a wedding ring. And I bought it for myself because I felt that I just wanted to have this piece of Bhutan with me and carry it home with me. And it does that for me. I'm looking at it now and just thinking very happily about the place, and it's a perfect transportable souvenir of sort of independence and of just love for this faraway kingdom.
I thought it was also interesting, you write about when you went back, you were aware that people would say, "How is Bhutan?" and really not mean it. They'd want you to go, "Oh, fine," and keep walking. How did you decide? I mean, there's that element, and then you thought, I want to sit down and really understand and explore this trip that I've taken by writing about it extensively.
You know, I had not gone on this, believe it or not, some people probably would not believe it, but when I went on that first trip, several of my colleagues at Marketplace and other good friends had said, take a camera, you know, write it all down, and honestly, I didn't. I had to force myself to do a couple of radio stories from there just because that's, you know, how I'm wired, and I felt guilty about being away from work, but it was only as the experience baked into me, if you will, over the next 6 months to a year, that it occurred to me that it was a universal story, this story of acceptance and growth and transformation of a place, and also just my growing fascination. The more I learned about Bhutan, the UTEP thing, it just blew my mind. It was just fantastic. It's like an uncovered story, and I felt so lucky to be in the catbird seat. So I think what happened was over time I realized I felt really excited about how good I felt, and I wanted to share the story. And Nawan coming to visit really sort of cinched it for me. And then I had gone back by then a second time and just found myself this process of writing. It sounds kind of pretentious, but anybody out there who does it, it's very cathartic. I feel fortunate that I published a book, but it's very cathartic if you just do it and put it away, and now you don't have to. You can blog it and know that people are out there reading it. There's something about writing about an experience that crystallizes it for you and kind of does a therapeutic number on you when you try to articulate what it is about a place that was so special. A good friend just had a baby this past couple of weeks ago in Los Angeles, and I realized it's so impossible for somebody to describe this life-altering, magnificent experience, but it's a good challenge to try.
Yeah. The Bhutanese native language, which I will not even attempt to mispronounce, has a word for hello, but not a word for goodbye.
Yeah, isn't that just so poetic? And
yeah.
How could I not write a book about a place that was poetic stuff from every direction? Yeah, Dzongka, it's called. Dzongka is language of the Dzongs, and Dzongs are the most majestic fortresses that are built in each district of Bhutan. And those really were the things that were the blueprints, if you will, for the UTEP buildings. So Dzong is language of the Dzong. And yeah, there's no goodbye. You just, now of course, everybody's speaking English, so they do say so long. But it's a lovely part of the language that there isn't a word.
Well, Lisa, we won't say goodbye, but we will say thank you so much for spending this hour with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And real quickly, Paul Maynard wrote to me during the break. He's out there listening, and he does three good things with photographs. He blogs them every week. So I thought that was a cool thing. We already got listener feedback as well as your pledge drive. I hope it does as well as it's going.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Journalist Lisa Napoli's most recent staff job was with American Public Media's Marketplace. Her book is called Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. You can receive a thank you copy of Lisa Napoli's book when you make a contribution this afternoon at or above the $120 level. You can do that by going online to KERA.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Senior producer of Think, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, Jeff Whittington is back. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. What a great conversation.
Yeah, she's so much fun. And it really is. I know it seems like I just love every book. I almost do. But this one really is a lot of fun to read. You don't have to think very hard when you read it, but it makes you think about important things.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's a really charming story. And she was great to be our guest today. If you enjoyed the show, well, then call us 888-694-6931 or go online and contribute at KERA.org. I do want to thank Stephen, who sent us an email, and he says, you know, I love this show. Just want to say thanks for such an excellent program. He says, I've called more than a few times to ask a question, and even in the years I was not able to give anything, I could feel secure that I would not be turned away from participating. This year I was able to contribute and feel like it was as much a thank you to KERA as it was to those people who contributed when I couldn't.
Stephen, thank you so much. What a nice thing to let us know and to have decided to do. So thank you very much. Really appreciate that.
Please join Stephen with an online contribution at KERA.org, or if you'd rather call and you can swing it this year, call 888-694-6931. Just $136,430 left to go in this drive. And as we've said from the beginning and always, once we reach that final dollar raise, the drive will end right then. If we can make it today or tomorrow, the drive will end at that point. And, you know, we'll have several months of pledge-free radio right here on KERA, a few months at least. And you know what? We really do appreciate everyone who has called or has gone online during this drive. Thousands of you have responded. We know that hundreds of thousands of you listen, though. So if you have resisted thus far, well, don't resist any longer. Join the station today and help us wrap this drive up in style.
When you talk about swinging a contribution, one thing that works for a lot of people who are on limited budgets is setting up a sustaining membership. This is a, you know, once-a-month draw from your checking account, and I think the minimum you can do is $5 a month when you set it up this way. There's no minimum if you want to, you know, call us with a credit card number or whatever, but if you set up a sustaining membership, you can do a pretty substantial gift over the course of a year that adds up, but it doesn't really have to affect your budget very much, if at all. For most of us out there, knock on wood, you know, $5 or $10 or $15 or $20 a month is easy to do, particularly given the amount of time you spend with public radio and specifically with KERA. We'd love to hear from you now to set that up at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
The drive will end, as we said, when we reach this goal, and your sustaining membership or your online credit card contribution will help us get there. If it's time for you to renew your membership, or maybe you made a sustaining gift last year and you can see clear to add a dollar or two a month to your current membership. Say you signed up at the $120 annual membership level, or $10 a month on the sustaining membership, and you can afford to go to $12 or $15 a month. Well, that would really help a lot right now, or even $11 a month. Just increasing your gift and calling 888-694-6931 or contributing or changing that information online at KERA.org would really go a long way for us to meet this goal, this remaining $136,000 and change that's left to go. Think about how much time you spend with the station. Think about what you get from this program, from all the programs that you hear on KERA, and make that contribution. Please do it right now.
You know, most things that are worth doing take a little effort. Most things that pay off take a little effort. You know, if you want to be in good shape, you have to work out regularly and eat properly. If you want to, you know, finish school, you have to study. If you really want to get the value from KERA, you can flip on the radio and it's there. But the truth is, it takes a little effort on the part of listeners, a little money on the part of listeners, in order to keep the station robust. You can help us out at any level by going online to KERA.org right now. Check out thank you gifts, including copies of Radio Shangri-La, Lisa Napoli's new book.
1-888-694-6931. Online at KERA.org. It is your source for NPR News 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. Also 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202DR in Wichita Falls, 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman, and streaming online all the time, worldwide on the World Wide Web. That's why they call it that, at kera.org.
Yes, worldwide, because we know that some of you, most of you perhaps, are listening within the region that is hit by our terrestrial broadcast towers. However, a growing number of KERA listeners, and specifically of Think listeners, are choosing other media to get this show. You listen through the podcast. You listen online at your computer, which can happen from anywhere in the world. If you've chosen this as your favorite show, if you've chosen KERA as your public radio station, we would hope that you also recognize that we would love a contribution of support from you at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
Please do your part. A whole another hour of Think coming up here with Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power, and he's got quite a CV himself coming up in the next few minutes. NPR News coming up. Please don't wait any longer, though. Please call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org.
Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.